Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, February 9th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, Precious Metals Market Report with Franklin Sanders. We've got a lot to talk about, that's for sure. Our theme tonight is the matrix steals to second base. Every time I turned around this week, we were watching all sorts of slick tricks, and I was so glad last week we talked to John Rappaport about the nuts and bolts of the matrix, because I was watching the various techniques unfold all week long. We have the transcript up from that interview, and it was a great one. If you haven't listened to it, I recommend or take a look at the transcript. There's some great insights that I think you might find valuable, and again, the feedback from subscribers was really terrific. And in fact, tonight, Franklin and I have been conversing this week about disinformation, so we're going to talk a little bit about disinformation in the precious metals market specifically. I'm going to be this Saturday in Palm Springs at the technically Indian Wells at the Cambridge House Natural Resources Conference. It's free if you register online. I think it's $20 if you come, but it's described and you can connect in the events section. And it's a real perfect time to be talking about natural resources. We just saw announcements today on Bloomberg that the U.S. Has reversed a two-year decline in energy independence. We're now estimated in the first 10 months of this, or in 2011, to be producing 81% of our energy domestic. Part of it is the decisions related to gas and the enormous increase in natural gas production in the country. In fact, we're now becoming a natural gas exporter. It's getting so significant. And today, NRC approved, the feds approved the first nuclear plant in decades. Two nuclear plants in Georgia got licenses from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is, wonder what Germany thinks of that after what they did after the tsunami. Very interesting development. So lots to talk about on the natural resource front. And then Sunday I'll be flying back from Palm Springs on Sunday morning, and I'll be at Friendly Favors in Emeryville talking about the global financial system. Again, you can link to that from the website. That'll be 2 hours of very interactive dialogue. It's free with donations requested, but you need to RSVP. So, again, link to it from the events section. There's a great new special Solari report. The hot topic of this tax season is foreign reporting. We've been disclosing the squabble with Vagland Bank in Switzerland and some of the efforts to bring in tax revenues. I'm going to be talking about it more with Franklin, but the pressure is on foreign reporting filing. If you follow Solari and follow the Solari blog, you know we write a lot about the FBAR forms, which is a form you're expected to file by June 30 of every year. If you had foreign holdings of certain kinds of more than $10,000 during the year before, then PFIC filings, Passive Foreign Investment Corporation, you've heard us talk about as well. But the new one this year, when you file your annual financials coming from its de facto requirements, coming from the higher jobs legislation in 2010, and there's something called a Form 8938, if you have more than $50,000 in a foreign financial account, that needs to be done. And I'm hoping this article will help you or this special report will help you, but feel free to print it out or give the link to your CPA or tax preparer or family or friends that you think are connected, because the fines if you are not compliant are pretty hideous. So, again, this is the hot topic of this tax season, so it's all there. A really good report by my attorney and Solari's Attorney General Counsel, Carolyn Betts. Money in markets. I don't know where to start. It was a busy week on the blog. First, and to me the most important story, is Brussels company Lairwise announcing the use of a 3D printer to make a new jaw for an elderly woman. Now, I've been following 3D printing. You've seen some videos on 3D printing up on the blog, but it's quite amazing. And it's a stunning example of what this kind of technology can do. You basically map the jaw, the old jaw on a CAD software, and literally a printer can make a duplicate jaw in what's called a 3D printer, and it's an incredible use of it. But I wanted to put that story up and bring it to your attention because It's important to understand that part of the changes that we're watching are not just about the pro-centralization team and actions of human beings. Technology is causing changes everywhere in everything, and there's a lot of creative destruction going on, and it's some of the bad behavior we're watching, as we talked like last week, is the organizations who can having trouble as their cash flows takes a dive. You know, so as Hollywood's cash flow takes a dive, they want to get more legislation to try and protect their cash flow. It's interesting. I'm reading an OECD study on the economy of satellites in space, and the strong dollar policy very neatly tracks the build-out of the satellite systems in the 90s. You can see it. You know, and I've always said that money only goes where enforcement can follow. So it's not surprising, but these are very deep changes that we're watching. At C-Lane, my money management company, I spend a lot of time looking at applied technology and what it's doing to energy and natural resources, but also manufacturing and healthcare. And what we're seeing in every industry across the board, whether it's in the emerging markets or in North America or Europe, is a bifurcation deep within all sort of enterprises between those who are applying these new technologies in their day-to-day operations and products and services and those who are not. And it's causing a real split in where the equity value is happening. And it's a fascinating process to watch, but it's causing all sorts of change and all sorts of, as I said, creative destruction. So part of what you're seeing the pro-centralization team doing is knowing this is coming and anticipating it and saying, okay, you know, let's get ahead of it. And part of what they're saying is we'd rather give everyone a government check than try and explain to them what robotics is all about. When I got back from Switzerland, I told the story of one of the activists in Switzerland at the conference that I attended in November, saying that he'd been given a grant from the Office of Naval Intelligence to help recruit robotics engineers in low-income communities, that the Office of Naval Intelligence estimated that we needed 400,000 new robotics engineers in the next 10 years in the USA alone. So a lot is moving into the machines, and it's one of the reasons no matter how much manufacturing we move back onshore, it's not necessarily going to achieve any kind of explosion in jobs. The maker movement, which I've written a lot about on the blog, I talked about in the wrap-up, reflects this development. It's a way of taking that technology and bringing it back to a successful application in our everyday lives, and it's a very positive thing if you haven't hooked into it. One of my goals in the Solari Report is I keep learning about these things is to keep you current on them. Because I think they're going to be important. Now, there are lots of ways this technology is not so wonderful, and we're seeing the announcement of this week with an announcement that drones are being introduced for domestic enforcement, and that includes farm surveillance, lockdown the food supply. The FAA Reauthorization Act, which Obama is expected to sign, orders the FAA to develop regulations for the testing and licensing of commercial drones by 2015. Big warning announcements from both the Federation of American Scientists, a very good group, and the Electronic Frontier Foundation. The FAA projects there will be 30,000 drones in the nation's skies by 2020, not just for police agencies or enforcement and electronic surveillance, but by private companies as well. I would just like to point out, of course, anticipating these trends, we talked about this development in our review for Let's Go to the Movies of The End of Violence, which is a wonderful Wim Wenders film starring Bill Pullman, and it's about this kind of technology, you know, sort of drones in the sky that can puppy train or worse a citizen. Anyway, if you haven't seen The End of Violence, it's on the list. At the end, in the year-end wrap-up, we did a list at the end and an appendix of all the movies we've done in Let's Go to the Movies since 2008, and I really encourage you to take a look at that list, but you'll find The End of Violence there. The big financial news this week was the banks yet again skate. It's, you know, I'm not surprised it's happening, but it's always painful to watch. The attorney generals have, or almost all of them, yet one still as of the time we went to to the Salieri report, it was outside the fold. But essentially, most of, if not all, of the attorney generals have come together under the leadership of the United States government into a jumbo mortgage settlement that lets the bank skates for all their fraud on the robo-signing and servicing. It's a very ugly package. It's being promoted as a lifeline to homeowners, the theory being that they're taking the money that the banks are scarfing up, and that will support refinancings and some kickbacks to borrowers who were foreclosed on. The part of the settlement is the big and most heinous banks. You have J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, I think Citibank, the old GMAC Alliance. And it's interesting. So I decided, upon looking at this very ugly settlement, to go into, at opensecrets.org, go into the financial filings of the candidates to see where they bank. And sure enough, Barack Obama banks at J.P. Morgan Chase. That's all. I did a little post up on the blog, and so you can go look at his financials and see, yes, he banks at J.P. Morgan Chase private banking. And Romney, it appears, from his financial statements, appears to bank at Bank of America. Although Romney's assets are so significant, I'm sure he probably has several banks. But it seems to me, if any of you intend to vote for either one of them, or you know anybody who intends to vote for one of them, I think they should be contacted, and the staff should be contacted, and it should be a condition of your vote that they personally move their money out of the banks that are doing all this fraud that they just allowed to skate. As a counterpoint, the city of Berkeley has announced, again, this is up on the blog, that they're going to move $300 million of bank deposits out of Wells Fargo and into a local bank. Now, this is a very significant move if you're a municipality, you've been banking at a bank for a long time. That's a very operationally complex move to make, and it's a very big one to move, but it's very important. So, of course, you know, the city council members of Berkeley are the hero of the week on the Salieri report. Touche to them. And let us hope that many other municipalities get the message and do likewise. There's a big uh-oh. The hacking group Anonymous, which yours truly does not believe is an independent hacking group, but somebody funded or with connections to the intelligence agencies, has announced Operation Seed Bomb. They're essentially encouraging everyone, and, you know, this is part two to Occupy Wall Street. Now they're encouraging everyone to start collecting and planting seeds. I have a very strong recommendation to avoid this with a 10-foot pole. You know, I think Operation Wall Street was very much a sort of something that was affected tremendously by this kind of op and entrainment technology. The idea of giving these guys an enormous database of everybody who's interested in fresh food and then hooking into something where they can use significant entrainment is, I do not think, a very good thing for the food movement. But I do think that this happening at the very time that we're watching lots of different things that enables them to get locked down of the seed and food supply, you know, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think there is such an explosion of interest in fresh food and such resistance to the lockdown plan that doing this kind of thing in the fresh food groups makes a whole lot of sense. Now let's turn to the financial markets. Two big uh-ohs. The Dow has been rising towards 13,000. And if you look at, there's just a number of signs that show sort of fundamental weakness. We see projections of earnings indicate, say, for the S&P 500, earnings could be down as much as 40% going forward. We see reports now of significant increase of corporate insider selling, not a good sign. And finally, the SEC comes out with a plan for money markets, concerned about what happened with money markets in 2008. All of these sort of signs of fundamental weakness. Meantime, yields just keep getting lower. It's like a limbo dance. How low can you go? I spent the last 2 weeks chasing Canadian yields, trying to get a Canadian sovereign bond for a client, and sure enough, the yields went negative. Now, these are short term. Then we tried to switch to an Australian. That didn't work. Yields down to nothing. And that's even with the dollar falling. Good corporates are very, in the short area, very hard to get anything decent above 1% now. And it's amazing to see the cost of capital go to zero for the large players, you know, come down to Main Street and the cost of capital is quite, you know, is something else. It's in the 30, 40, 50% range. The latest Shadow Stat reports, God bless John Williams, he just keeps calculating the statistics, show inflation running at 6% and unemployment at 22.5%. So if you're getting a 0% yield or a 1% yield on your CDs, but your food price inflation is running at 6% or higher, and 22.5% of you in your household can't get employed, that's a very ugly picture, and that's at the heart of the slow burn. That 22.5% compares to unemployment at the peak of the Great Depression of 25%. It's getting close, but they didn't have food stamps. If you look at the food stamps number, they continue to explode. 2011, we had 44.7 million people on food stamps. That's almost a double from 2007 when we had 26 million. New proposals from Treasuries promoting annuities. They're trying to promote the concept of you know, don't have assets, have a lifelong earning flow annuity is better, then you'll never run out of money. Of course, they're saying that as inflation is, real inflation is running at 6% and the dollar is being debased. As I said before, I never met an annuity that I like. So with that, as you can see from the new cartoon that we have on the blog and on the homepage, I'm in Pleasanton in San Francisco Bay Area. And Franklin is at Top of the World Farm. So, Franklin, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Yeah, well, you're about the busiest man on the planet. I've been teasing Franklin all week about how busy he is. Anyway, Franklin, there is so much going on in the precious metals market. I don't know where to start, but I know you do. Bring us up to date on the market since we talked last month. How are we doing and what's going on?
Well, what we did was really pretty remarkable because gold and silver both broke out of and broke through the downtrend lines from the downtrends that had been established since gold and silver both fell off in September. And so what that means is that you've got – it's clearly turned around. Now – when I say clearly, of course, I'm going to put all sorts of footnotes and qualifications on that. But there are two numbers that I really look at closely. One is the 300-day moving average in silver, and the other one is the 150-day moving average in gold. And the reason I look at those is because generally those have served as a safety net for gold and silver over the course of this bull market. And by that, what I mean is they just very seldom go below those numbers. And when they do go below those numbers and come back up through them, then that is a significant buying opportunity because you've had a correction, you've had a bottom, and now it's ready to go up again. And here's where the rally has stalled, because although gold went through its 150-day moving average, and has kept on going. Silver did not move through its 300-day moving average. So there's a kind of a non-confirmation there. And what I think is that you're going to get a correction that may take silver down to $31, maybe, could go lower. And gold might go as low as 1650. But there's not much question that they've already bottomed. I think we saw the lows in December, on the 29th of December, and now from here they're going to resume their upward climb. So in other words, you've gotten your notification, hey, low price has been reached, fixing to start climbing again. And when I say fixing to start climbing again, I mean they may go sideways for the first half of this year, but after that, they're going to go much, much higher. And when I say much, much higher, you know, I mean, I don't, you know, Captain, I don't throw around numbers a lot, but I think the top of this particular leg that we're in is probably $4,500, and for silver probably $150 or more. So this is going to be a huge move up. This is going to be bigger than even than anything we've seen yet. So the difference between 1730 and 1850 is not going to look very big 2 years from now.
Right. Right. I remember. I remember 2004 torturing because I was working with a client and we just delayed a little bit and we had to pay $400 instead of $399. And I remember being very depressed about it. Now I look back and I say, why?
What difference does that make? Exactly.
What difference does that make? Right. And, so many times in the last 5 years, Franklin, generally in about 90% of the time when I don't wait and I just go ahead and buy, 90% of the time I'm better off. And yet I find myself every week in a situation where a subscriber or a client is new to the market, and the question is, should they take their core position now or should they wait? And, you know, it may just be a dollar, it just may be $5, but, you know, every penny counts. So
right.
I find myself tortured about these things every day, despite the, you know, you would think after listening to you all these years I'd have a little more perspective.
Well, I know, but I do the same thing to myself, you know, and what we're doing is that, as the cliche goes, we're letting the good be the enemy of the better, or the however they say it. But I mean, you know, you can't get perfection in markets. If we were trying to do that, then we'd be trading this stuff every day, in and out, and trying to make a profit that way. Well, we're not doing that. We're not even trying to do that. That would be a very, you know, that's not a good way to play it. And if you're playing the long term. And the primary trend, you have to play the primary trend. You can't keep, you know, throwing your eyes around the world and saying, oh, gosh, the grass is greener over there, because you'll just get yourself in trouble.
So let's look at the new – somebody who's new to the precious metals market. What should they do today? Should they wait? Should they buy? Should they buy some to get a core position and buy some later? What would you advise?
Well, that latter sounds like a good thing, but one thing about it is if you get gold closing above 1805 and silver above 3450, stop waiting. Do not wait.
Right.
Buy. But just
right.
Blindly buy, because above those levels, it has broken out to a new rally. And what you're going to see here, you know, markets often go back for the final kiss goodbye when they break out. They break out. They go up a little ways, and then they come back to the downtrend line or the place where they broke out, and they make what we call a final kiss goodbye. And then they turn around, and they're gone after that. They just skyrocket after that. So, I don't think waiting is a good idea. I think you've already seen the lowest prices. They may be slightly lower, and you may get buy silver some lower, but you're just going to be shooting yourself in the foot in the end, because when it gets down, if right now if silver dropped down to 28, I'll guarantee you that same vacillation would be on you saying, well, maybe it'll go to 27.5, and you just have to go in and buy it, because as I said, you're buying it for the long term. You know, turning to the currencies if we can.
Yeah, please.
Something really weird was going on there in the last week and a half, where almost every day the yen cost about 100 yen cost about 131 cents, and a euro cost about 131 cents. And those markets don't go that flat for that long. So I suspect that our friends in the government were manipulating that market to try and keep the yen,
Somebody wanted parity.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what it looks like, to try to keep that euro from dropping too much against either the yen or the dollar. And the dollar, it's not clear that the dollar is ready to sink, because the dollar has gotten down to 78.50, the dollar index, and it refuses to go down below 78.50. So you know, it's not clear what's going to happen in the currencies, but I think for the euro, it's as good as it gets. What you saw today, well, maybe, you know, when the Greek parliament finally approves the debt deal, that might be a tiny bit better. But basically, it's as good as it gets. There isn't any more good news. And that market did not sink today on the news that the deal had been practically consummated. Well, normally what would happen is on news like that, all those people who were expecting the euro to go down and who were expecting the deal to fall through, the euro to drop, they would be short euros. But and they would close out their positions when that didn't happen. Well, that nothing changed. The euro just barely moved. It was like 0.2%, which is not a big move. And nothing happened with stocks either. And supposedly the cloud hanging over stocks has been what would happen with the European crisis. So those markets are not reacting the way they ought to.
Well, when you look at earnings projections, though, because the projected earnings are way down.
Yeah.
Or you look at the Baltic Dry Index, what I see everywhere I turn around is you see slowing. You know, it's almost as everything is stalled. And, of course, stalling is not good news for commodities, particularly industrial commodities. So I know before the call I got you to go take a look at the Baltic Dry Shipping Index. It's a swan dive down. But if Europe is in a real serious recession, that means slowness for the United States, and that means slowness for the emerging markets too.
Right. They're not independent of each other. That's right. For sure. Yeah. So I don't, you know, right now, I think we've got probably a little correction on the table with gold and silver, and that went, and I would only alter that. That would only be contradicted if you saw silver go below 2615 and gold go below 1530. And I certainly don't expect that. I think the worst is behind us now. I do think that we're going to get a chance to swap gold for silver at 57.5 or a little better. I think you're going to get weakness in the stock market, and when that happens, the silver moves very strongly in its direction against gold. Silver moves kind of in the same direction that stocks move. So if you get a lot of weakness in gold, then you can if you get a lot of weakness in stocks against gold, then you're going to get weakness in silver against gold too. And I think you'll see that sometime soon, and then that ratio will start coming down again. And this time, it'll right now it's about 51.3, and this time it'll go down to 30, 28.
Right, that's I forget who was it. I guess it was you saying 4,500 for gold and 150 for silver, which is a 30 ratio.
Right. Well, Al Field had an article about that, but those are numbers that I'd come to independently, so that makes them even – that they have that much more weight to me. If somebody as bright as he is looks and sees that too, then maybe there is something there. Makes it look like a better forecast.
So you think that could happen in the next couple months?
Oh, gold going to 4,500? No.
The ratio going to 57. In other words,
it will happen, or it'll either happen in the next 2 months, or it'll never happen.
Okay.
You know, there's not a lot of time for that.
Okay. So if somebody wants to swap, they should work out in their minds how they're going to do it now. And be
all
ready.
The arrangements need to be made now, because that is, you don't have time to change that.
Right.
You don't have time to do it when it actually happens, and it's a week later and you hear about it. There's no time to do it. Yeah, they ought to put in open orders to do it, or else they ought to watch it pretty closely.
Okay. So I want to talk. I have a couple questions, and then I want to talk a little bit about the longer run. A couple questions. One question was, why do you use Elliott Wave analysis? Often when you talk, you sounds like you're using more standard charting techniques. What's the argument for Elliott Wave?
I don't have an argument for Elliott Wave. There are people who claim that it works. It's clearly, I'm too dumb to figure out how it works. The only reason that I use it is in retrospect. In other words, after a market has done some, has made a big move, you can, it's easier to pick it out to me then. I can't predict with it because every Elliott Wave practitioner I've ever used, I've ever listened to, and believe me, they're smarter than I am. I don't claim anything else. But everyone that I've ever used just pulls rules out of the air so fast that I can't keep up with them. It was once described to me as by a friend of mine who's a third-generation commodity trader as the technical system that's cost more people more money than any other technical system known to man. And that may be true. I don't know. But I don't use it except in retrospect. In other words, to sort of prove where I've been.
Okay. Okay. And then what do you use to, you're tracking, well, you just said you used,
Well, I look at moving averages and then I look at lateral, support and then I look at, downtrend lines and uptrend lines and I look for patterns on charts. When you start looking at charts, it's pretty plain that you get areas where the market is trying to go up and it can't get through those areas and it'll try twice and then suddenly it'll burst through. Well, that's an area of resistance. And then if you turn that upside down, it's an area of support. And those patterns are pretty plain on the chart. I mean, those areas are pretty plain on the chart. And then there are patterns like equilateral triangles or rising wedges or falling wedges. All those things. It's a very bad idea to go to make a decision against those technical indicators because people have used them for years and years for a reason, namely because they have a pretty high predictive value. So.
Okay. So a second question, there's been a sprinkling of articles around the internet talking about the possibility of special taxes on gold and silver, particularly if we get the kind of move up that you're talking about, or even confiscation. And we have a question from one subscriber saying, is there any merit to switching to platinum or palladium to avoid those kind of special taxes?
I don't think there is. I don't expect those special taxes in the first place. I mean, you have to really stretch your mind to picture the government doing that particular thing. Just like I can't stretch my mind far enough to see the government confiscating gold or silver. And of course they might put special taxes on, they'll call them windfall profits taxes or something like that. But I really don't think they would do that. And typically they don't do that unless it's part of some other great big huge so-called reform. So I don't see any advantage to that. Another thing I don't like about platinum and palladium is that the market is not nearly as liquid as the market for silver and gold, and so the spread that you have to pay is larger than it is for silver and gold. But I'm not enthusiastic about platinum and palladium because they're both very quirky. They have quirky demand profiles. They have quirky supply profiles. And I don't see how platinum and palladium are going to do very well. Now, they may rise, but I don't see how they're going to do very well in an economy that's headed down because they're both, the demand for both is determined by industrial demand.
Right.
And how many automobiles, that automobile catalysts are very large factors in the consumption of both platinum and palladium. How many automobiles are going to be built during a depression or a recession? So I'm not saying that platinum and palladium are bad, but I would not have a huge investment in them in relation to gold or silver. They're just too quirky.
If you were to look for a wild card that could bring the price of gold and silver down a lot, would a rise in interest rates be the most likely thing? What could bring gold and silver?
No, the election of Ron Paul would be the most likely thing. because if Ron Paul got into office, then the days of the Fed would be numbered, and the economy would begin to recover, and people would go back to investing in productive assets instead of having to buy gold and silver to protect their assets from monetary depreciation. I think it's going to be very simple. The interest rate, it's true, has an effect on the price of gold. But at some point in an inflation, the inflation is such a danger that even high interest rates cannot tempt investors out of it. Do you know how high Volcker had to twist interest rates to squeeze the gold and silver market to death in 1980?
21%. 21%.
24%.
I don't remember that, but it could have been. Yeah, it could have been. All I know is the long bond, the New York 30-year bond for New York State was 18%.
Well, just think about that. That's a long ways from 0% that your friend Mr. Bernanke has said he's going to keep interest rates at until 2014, which is two more years.
Well, remember, he's keeping them at 0% for the big guys. But if you are on Main Street and you're trying to get a loan, forget it. So
well, you're
you know,
just not going to get the loan.
Right. So, you know, it's 30 to 90% on Main Street, although it's 0% at your local hedge fund who's buying, you know, who Obama wants to sell the foreclosed properties to.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, it's
But I
this
can't,
gets,
they're not going to raise, what can Obama do? I mean, Bernanke do? What's he going to do? Raise interest rates to 17% overnight? Not going to do that. I mean, you know, if he lets them rise, he's going to let them rise 0.5% a quarter at the most for a year or 2 years.
But if he wants to manage commodity prices down, he can just keep raising margin requirements. I mean, margin requirements will buy you a lot.
That's true.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But interest rates won't.
It's interesting. If you were, I heard a great presentation on the radio the other day about a guy was talking about if, you know, what happens if we lose the futures market and people can't hedge their businesses. It was a very compelling presentation. But let me ask you something, Franklin. Would you, as a small farmer, this year use the futures market to hedge your crop after what happened with MF Global? I'd be afraid to.
Oh, I don't see how you could have any trust in that. You'd have to go, what will happen is that there will be another market will form, but it'll be an over-the-counter market. In other words, there won't be an open outcry central market like the COMEX is today. But people who run grain elevators, for instance, will offer offer futures contracts in effect.
Right.
They'll make deals. But anybody, I think you've gotten to the point where you can't trust the market. Remember, it wasn't MF Global as a broker going down that was so astonishing or created a new situation. That's happened many times in the past. What creates the new situation is that the COMEX messed over their customers. That's what the new situation is. And if the COMEX stabs the customer in the back, then that's the end of the COMEX. If you can't trust them, there's nobody you can trust. Forget the broker.
Because not only did they stab him in the back, but they, you know, I was walking in to get coffee 2 weeks ago, and there on the Wall Street Journal was the headline, customer money accounts money lost in chaotic trading. Well, you and I both know in both the securities and the banking system, nothing clears without, you know, it going from one, you know, there's a debit and there's your credit.
Right.
So I don't care how chaotic the thing is, the transfer, there's a credit, there's a debit and there's a credit.
Right.
And so it went someplace. It's, you know, the whole society, we keep hearing that. So it's not just that they stole the money, but they lied, you know, a lie that without any, you know, it's almost sort of thumbing your nose at somebody or worse, because it's,
well, like
not, you know, we're not even going to bother to come up with a good lie.
Right. It's like today's deal with the banks. They're parading around like they're heroes now. The banks are. What? They got the government to set up a deal where all of their bad paper will be converted to good paper. The paper they can't enforce is going to be converted to good paper.
Right. And that's their payback
for... State attorney generals are throwing out their chests and strutting around about how they showed those banks. Yeah, right. They showed the banks. Sure they did.
Okay, so I want to go out and talk about the end game because where all this is going. CBO published an annual report, and I put a blog commentary up. It's off the homepage now, but if you just put in CBO in the search box, you can pull it up. And it's stunning, Franklin, because remember, this is an election year. And I'm used to the Congressional Budget Office not publishing things in election year that's going to get anybody in trouble.
Right.
And yet, here we have the CBO saying that growth, the GNP growth this year is going to be about 2%, and the next year after the election, it's going to be 1%. Now, if they're expanding the money supply at 10% or greater,
right,
and the GNP is going up at 1%, that means we're shrinking by 9%.
That means it's not working anymore.
Right. It's not working anymore.
This is the same phenomenon that an alcoholic experiences when he finds out that quart of vodka won't do the job anymore, and he's having to buy handles now, you know, half gallon.
Right.
So that's what that means. But, you know, here's the thing about that CBO report that really I find scary. Susan and I were driving up to Nashville today. I had to take her up to Nashville, and we were listening to the radio, and one of the items pointed out in the Greek debt deal was that they would reduce pensions. And I turned around and looked at Susan. I said, reduce pensions? So here you've got people that have been working all these years. They expect to retire. And, you know, I don't know a lot of working people who have cushy pensions. And now all of a sudden they find out they're not going to be able to get all of their pensions. Well, that's exactly
USA News 3 days ago had a big story. It's up on the blog. 9 states moved to reduce pension benefits. When Panetta's been squabbling with the military, big article USA Today on the cushy benefits for the military and whether or not they should be cut back. So, you know, we've been talking about this on the Salieri Report a lot, but I think one of the end games is absolutely to debase and cut all the retirement promises.
Well, exactly, and that's what shows up in this CBO report, because it shows that the crisis in Social Security comes not in 2022, as the Social Security Administration says, but in 2019, and it comes with instead of an $8 billion hole, it comes with $1.2 trillion hole, something like that. So, in other words, people now who are on Social Security already, they're going to get out there and they're going to find out Social Security can't pay anymore. And look, let's face it, Catherine, Social Security does not keep you living in the lap of luxury.
Right.
You do not buy fine wines on the Social Security income. And you have to understand, two-thirds of the people in some of our states have no other income but Social Security.
Right.
Nothing. So what are they going to do? Let those people starve? What will happen when those people do not get Social Security?
Well, but let's look at the federal budget outlays. One of the things, another thing in the CBO study is they say unemployment's going up next year. They have it going up from, I think, 8-point-something to over 9, say 9.2, and of course that 9 number is a big number. Now again, John Williams at ShadowStats is saying it's 22.5 now. So we're talking about approaching Great Depression levels, although not, you know, the Great Depression didn't have the level of sort of food stamps and other things. But
right,
what that means to U.S. government budget outlays, let's take a look at. In 2000, the budget outlays were $1.9 trillion. 2011, they're $3.8 trillion. So we're talking about a squeeze coming across the board. And that, if you look at those outlays, part of that is just the money supply expanding. In 2001, the monetary base was $6.6 billion. In 2012, it was $2.6 trillion. So it's gone up, what, four times?
Yeah.
Much more than the outlays. That's part of the squeeze and the slow burn.
But I think you have to point out, too, that these things are already baked into the cake.
Right.
These are not – we're not talking about problems that will arise if things get worse. They're already there. The numbers are already there.
Right. It's – and now I mentioned this earlier, the when you look at what the CBO was saying about the budget – when I was doing the articles on the missing money, Franklin, on the $4 trillion that went missing from federal agencies, individual taxes, I helped Kelly Amir do a big cover story for Insight Magazine. Individual tax receipts that year, it was 2000 or 2001, was $1.6 trillion. And corporate income was almost $600,000, about $550 billion. So we're talking about, you know, over $2 trillion. Mm-hmm. What the CBO is projecting for this year is that individual receipts are down over 33%. It's at $1.15 trillion and corporate at about $250. So not even $1.5 trillion. That's a huge drop in revenues. And when you look at everything we're saying, what you're looking at is a machinery. You know how I'm always talking about how federal government investment in places has a negative return on investment?
Right.
Well, what's happened is the negative return has gone on long enough and gotten deep enough that now it's cutting into their revenues. So the machine has turned so much negative that it doesn't have enough revenues to keep feeding the machine. And as we're watching the U.S. attack the Swiss over getting, you know, getting all those accounts wrapped up and into the tax system, and trying to shut off any leakage of that money going abroad. You know, they want it coming through this channel. You know, you're talking about a machinery that is literally desperate for revenues. It's a desperate machine. Now, somebody knows this, and this is a credit to Simon Block, who sent out this email today with some great statistics in it. He had the number of FBI background checks to obtain a firearm in the United States.
Uh-huh.
In 2004, there were 8.7 million. Guess how many there were in 2011?
More, I'll bet.
16.45 million.
Whoa.
You know, so it's a doubling. It's a doubling. So, you know, whether it's a doubling of food stamps or a doubling of firearms or a doubling of outlays, the model, you know, you've got a negative return on investment model, and it's going around and around. And I put up a great quote, and it was in our update today from it was a recent quote from Ron Paul.
Mm-hmm.
And let me pull it up for you because it was so funny. He's such a funny guy. Wait a minute. It was on the update. Oh, he said, "The government is run by special interests clawing away at a shrinking pie, and things are becoming quite vicious." Because, you know, it's funny, because the guys over in Davos at the World Economic Forum were talking about we need to change the model. And, you know, I said when I was up at the Rogue Valley, we were talking about the same thing, but from a different perspective. And the reality is, if everything's in this negative return on investment, you know, fighting and getting more vicious isn't going to solve anything. You have to change the model. And
right.
And so I think the question for every one of us is, okay, what do I do? What's next? What's my next step? And, you know, because there's no point in waiting for the guys in Washington to change the model. They're just going to, you know, it looks to me like there is no end game. So we're going to have to create the end game. And with that, before we get off this topic, I wanted to talk about the annuity proposal from Treasury, which, of course, in the face of the numbers we've just described, makes me very nervous about my clients' IRAs and 401ks, because you see Treasury coming out and promoting annuities and the importance of baby boomers having a lifelong income instead of just an asset. They can take an asset and convert it to a lifelong income, so they have income as long as they live. Well, if inflation is running at 6% and the dollar's debasing, the idea of converting that into an asset, you know, that is debasing, or a lifelong income that is debasing, is not very attractive to me. Now, you know me, I keep saying I've never met an annuity I liked, but I think, you know, I look at that, Franklin, and I say, is this a way to help build the operational infrastructure they need to figure out how to get all the service providers in that world? Because we're talking, you know, if we talk both 401ks and IRAs, we're talking about $7 or $8 trillion and enormous fee flows to the financial institutions. And as a matter of disclosure, I should include myself. And so, you know, that's a lot of detail to get worked out. So you never start with the big bang of mandating, you know, that everybody's money become an annuity. We have, I should just mention, in the commentary we have on the blog, we have links to a lot of our old posts about the different proposals for mandatory annuities. So you can look at the history of this thing to your heart's content. But I just think this annuity proposal makes me even more nervous. You got any thoughts about that?
Well, I never met an annuity I liked either. And I've just talked to a lot of older people who are my customers who've just been taken to the cleaners by annuities. And if you have inflation rates like what we've had in the last few years, it takes a very short time for the loss in your annuity payment, for the loss in purchasing power in your annuity payment to show up. And, you know, an annuity only works where you have a stable or deflating currency. Otherwise, it's
right.
Just nothing but a certificate of confiscation.
Right. Has anybody ever come up with an annuity priced in gold?
No, but, you know, I've showed a lot of people how to make a self-administered gold annuity. And basically, you know, an annuity is a pile of you give somebody a pile of money, and they give you back the money in dribs and drabs over a long period of time. And they're hoping that they can make enough interest using your money to pay you back. Well, why do you need somebody else to do that for you? Why can't you just go out, take your pile of money, go buy a pile of gold, and then as you need money, you sell off an ounce of gold or half an ounce or 2 ounces or whatever you need. And, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out. If you're 70 years old, you figure, well, I've got another 20 years to live, and I want to have X number of dollars a month to live on, let's just say $1,750, which is an ounce right now, then all I have to do is multiply 20 by 12, and I get 240 months, so I need 240 ounces. And, you know, I just hope I die when the gold runs out, that's all.
Right.
But it's very simple to do, and you just administer it yourself. It's not hard.
Right, I know. I give huge weight to maintaining control.
Yes.
So why not just keep control so that if something starts happening or the world changes, you're flexible, you can fire them and take your money and go someplace else. And,
well, exactly. And if you've got a self-administered gold annuity, what you can do is when that day comes, and we know it will come, that it's time to get out of silver and gold, you can take your annuity, sell the gold or silver, and then go buy yourself whatever investment makes the most sense then. So, yeah, I agree with you. You keep control. You keep both custody or title. You have custody and control. You have title and control to your own annuity. Why do I need an annuity company to do that for me?
Well, because what you have to do is you have to live with the uncertainty and volatility and the organic reality of the world. But what I found is there is enormous benefits to learning to live with that. You know,
in the last 10 years, it's all been on your side, right?
Yes.
In the last 10
yes.
years, all of that volatility has worked in your benefit. If you were holding either gold or silver, the volatility has worked in your benefit because even though it goes up and down, the long-term trend of the dollar is down and the long-term trend of the gold and silver is up, and they rise faster than the dollar loses purchasing power. Right.
Well, if you look across the markets, as long as you're in a primary trend,
uh-huh.
the volatility works in your favor. It's not just gold and silver. It's any primary trend, it works in your favor.
Right.
So,
well, I mean, I'm looking at my year-end summaries now, and I see that the average gain for silver since 2001, yearly gain, average yearly gain, which takes all the volatility and irons it out, is 20.3%. And the average gain for silver is 17.1%. Well, clearly, if you started out back then with an annuity, it's been working in your favor this whole time.
Right. Okay, so let me turn to a new topic of conversation. And let's go to the movies. I have posted World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, and the TED Talk, a link to the TED Talk by a public teacher in Virginia. And Franklin, how this guy got away with this, I don't know. You know, if he'd been in New York or L.A., he'd probably be dead for doing this. But the guy has created a world peace game, and it's really about global geopolitics and the economy. And the thing is unbelievably realistic and unbelievably detailed. And you got fourth graders talking about geopolitics the way I talk about geopolitics, and everybody says, oh, you know, you're brilliant. You know so much, blah, 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 blah. It's incredible. I mean, if you look at the education these kids are getting, they're really getting an education about how the world and the economy really work as a dynamic ecosystem. It's wonderful. It's amazing. And it's a reminder that we really can understand the economy and we really can understand how the world works if we have the right tools. And I wanted to post it because I had a wonderful breakfast with some people in San Francisco, just bright, talented, creative, and we were talking about economics and how we teach each other about economics, how we learn about finance and money. And I wanted to just mention, I have something called Economics, a curriculum, Economics 101. My pastor asked me to write something for his high school class, and not knowing how to write curriculum, I just did it anyway. Anyway, but it when I finished looking at it, I said, wow, this is something any group of adults could sit down and do. And another link that we'll post with this Solari report that I mentioned when I was talking at breakfast was, and it's something I think I've talked to you about before, Franklin, there's a wonderful group in Vermont that has something called Community Questing, and they mm-hmm. design treasure hunts to teach people about the history and ecology of their place.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating. They have two books now. We'll post the links. But I wanted to mention all these things to you because if we're going to learn about our world and if we're going to learn about our economy and if we're going to start, all solutions require that we get out of ourselves and start to look around us and say, okay, what's going on in this financial ecosystem or what's going on in this food ecosystem and where is there an opportunity for me to make a positive difference in a way that's good for me? But it starts with taking the time to understand, you know, everything around you. And it's funny, if you look at all the different businesses that Franklin's built, and you, I'll just brag on Franklin now, but if you talk to him and his family about how they got going, which you hear all these stories about, oh, well, you know, we saw that there was this missing in the world and they needed this and blah, blah, blah. And so you get a picture of people who are not looking at their own trouble so much as they're looking around and saying, what needs to be done and how do we do that in a way which is mutually energizing? And in this sort of milieu of just sitting around and learning, we've got to make it fun. You know, one of the things I saw when I was up in Rogue Valley and up in Montana is, Franklin, everybody feels strained by the negativity of so many of the things that are going on. And that's why I think it's essential that we recommit ourselves to having fun. Whenever I come over to the Top of the World Fun, whenever I come over to the Top of the World Farm, I'm always struck by how much fun you guys are having. So the way to solve all solutions are going to require we get out of our own problems and look around and see what's need doing. But I wanted to suggest to you that there are ways to do it. We'll put up those links if they're helpful. And there are ways to do it that are fun, which is absolutely, absolutely essential. I don't know if you wanted to add anything to that, Franklin, because you're someone who understands, you know, your economy, all the economy around you.
Well, I just, you know, you say that it has to be fun. I couldn't get my wife to do it if it weren't fun. So I don't really have any choice about that. But why would you keep on doing something you don't like? I mean, I think one of the tragedies of modern life is that people keep on doing, out of a sense of duty or maybe out of a sense of desperation, they keep on doing this thing that they don't really like to do. And the fact is, most successful people will tell you, yeah, I can't wait to go to work in the morning. I really love doing it.
See, the greatest way to tell that there's no market there is because you're not having fun. No. It's your spirit will tell you where there's, you know, it's what Thomas Up calls the juice. You know, you find the juice. And in that, I just wanted to mention quickly before we go, I had a great conversation. I was telling Franklin about this earlier. I got a email from the editor of McTribe, which is a website and magazine that covers apps. And he said, we're doing a story on financial apps, and we wanted to talk about the Gold and Silver Calculator app, which we now have an iPhone and Android app. And Franklin and I keep suggesting to everybody that they start transacting with gold and silver currency. You know, don't talk about whether or not you can create a community currency. Just do it. So I got on the phone with this guy, fascinating, brilliant guy. We'll see what the article looks like. You know, but I said, Franklin, we talked about currency. We talked about food systems. And we talked, what we really talked about was, okay, why do you have to have control of your food system, you know, and why do you need a free food system? Why do you need free currencies? Why do you need all these things to be free? And it was amazing because this guy who's got an IT background could follow me between food and money and freedom and places and the global financial system. You know, he could go up to the top and down to the bottom and across. And I thought, well, this is really helpful. Because something is happening that are helping people integrate all the dots. And I think part of the tapeworm coming out of the closet and Congress proposing 30,000 drones flying around in our skies is getting people to realize, oh, you know, this is about everything. It's not about this or that. It's about everything. And to me, that was an unbelievably positive development.
Well, but see, Catherine, there are a lot of people out there like that. And they feel isolated, or maybe the people they run into are the sort of people that you characterize as having negative energy. But there are a lot of people out there. It's not, you know, part of the lie is that the whole country's gone to hell. Everybody's just a welfare drag, you know, and welfare drone, and all the entrepreneurial people are gone. That's not true at all. I mean,
that's not true at all.
Every day.
And if there's any message I'm learning from going around, and you know, we've been having lunches with subscribers as I go around, you know, the message is you're not alone. There are a lot of it's just what that client of mine predicted this year. He's a very smart guy. He said the people on the line are going to find themselves in 2012, and that's going to change everything. So. Okay, well, Franklin, God bless you. Thank you so much for everything, and. We'll be talking next month.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Okay, so coming up next week, we have healthcare proxies. Very important topic. This is a nuts and bolts issue. I want you to understand why you do not want to be in the traditional medical system alone without an advocate who's got the power to rock and roll on your behalf. And then in the first week of March, I'm going to do something I'm calling Living by Faith. I gave a speech in Ashland about sort of the big issues, law, leadership, love, freedom, and some of this is in response to a lot of questions I've gotten over the last 2 years on the Solari report. One of the most popular questions was, what happened when you thought you were going to be killed in a couple of different instances, you know, sort of a gruesome topic. But there, you know, those stories are really about the core decisions and how do we live by faith as opposed to basically by intellect or logic. And so I want to talk about those big issues because I think they're very, very important to having fun and living in this kind of environment. So that'll be the first week in March. Again, I'm going to be in outside of Palm Springs at the Cambridge House Natural Resources conference on Saturday, and then Friendly Favors in Emeryville in the Bay Area on Sunday. You can find more out, link to those two events. The first is free if you register online. The second is free unless you want to make a donation. So that's Southern California on Saturday and the San Francisco Bay Area, Northern California on Sunday. So until next week with Healthcare Proxies, please remember, until we meet again, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.